From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one student calls out her Michigan high school for racial discrimination.
Past and present racism is something that every American community faces and must actively work against, and Ann Arbor is no exception.
We'll speak with the attorney representing a student at Pioneer High. Also, the logistics of a hands-on business like massage therapy in the time of COVID.
Testing for asymptomatic folks is taking maybe 10 days to 2 weeks. So I'm not sure that me getting tested would be helpful each day when I'm seeing clients.
And the editor of Car and Driver talks about addressing all auto enthusiasts, not just white guys.
The auto industry is going through the same stuff it went through in 2008, 2009. There's so many other voices and so many other impacted communities. Nobody's really fully addressing what's happening in the auto industry.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, it's a conversation with the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine on how the auto industry and industry analysis has been shaped by COVID. But first, the nation is grappling with yet another police shooting. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, just on the other side of Lake Michigan, Jacob Blake, a black man, was shot by police while entering the driver's side of an SUV over the weekend. His three children were in the vehicle. Detroit's policing protests, which have been relatively peaceful, took a different turn over the weekend as 42 people were arrested. When you scratch the surface of the Black Lives Matter movement, you don't have to look very deep to find that black boys and girls often feel a disparate treatment beginning from a very early age, long before they may even have any interactions with police. Today, a black student at Ann Arbor's Pioneer High School has filed a civil rights complaint with the state, alleging racial discrimination and an overall hostile environment for black students at the school. Liza Davis works on the University of Michigan Law School's Civil Rights Litigation Initiative, and she is representing the student in this complaint. Liza Davis, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
Can you tell us about the allegations? What are the kids saying happened?
So the kids are, saying on a general level, they do not feel welcome and like valued members of the community, and that they feel that they are being treated differently because of their race. To name a few examples, a student told us about an economics class where they had an exercise to play an online game to see who could own the most slaves by the end of the game. And, that's just really hurtful and harmful and just incredibly distressing. We also heard that black students are constantly followed around at school by teachers and hall monitors, and that this would only happen with a white student if they were, deemed an extreme troublemaker. On this issue, we've also heard a lot about the unequal policing of black students and students of color at Pioneer, where, they're receiving harsher punishments than their white classmates who are doing the same thing. A black student might be texting in class and get sent to the principal's office, but a white student doing the same thing gets to stay in class without any penalty. Something else that I think really showcases the racially hostile environment at Pioneer is that most students could only recall 2 to 3 black teachers in the entirety of the high school. And this is a high school that serves over 1,800 students, and it has a 47% minority student population. And so, there are a lot of, the list just goes on and on, but these are some of the more egregious examples of the racially hostile environment at Pioneer.
It's one thing to bring up these issues and to say that they're going on, but there's a long distance between that and filing a civil rights complaint with the state. What were the circumstances that sort of elevated these allegations and amplified the concerns that some of the students, and some of their families had?
Well, primarily it happened because of our client, Michaela Kelsey. A lot of these issues the students say have been going on for years and for generations of black students and students of color. But the way that Michaela Kelsey was treated this year was sort of, the tipping point, or also the epitome of, the problems with systemic racism at Pioneer. And so Michaela primarily faced a lot of issues with a specific math teacher, but those issues were not only emblematic of how this math teacher treats black students and students of color more generally, but how Pioneer treats Black students and students of color more generally.
Yeah. What would you and the student you represent like to see change at Pioneer?
Well, we are specifically asking Pioneer and Ann Arbor Public Schools. We've sent them a 14-page demand letter today describing what Michaela has faced, as well as the other Black students and students of color I spoke with this summer. We would like to see them hire an external civil rights organization to investigate the environment at Pioneer that students have to face. You know, this could include things like seeing if the faculty and staff reflect the racial and cultural diversity of the student population, to see if the curriculums are actually global curriculums and not just focusing on European history and culture, as well as this external organization would make recommendations that would that the school would then implement to make itself more equitable and make its environment better for students of all races. We also want them to create a race discrimination complaint system, as there is not one right now. There's no way for students to formally complain, and there's no way for Ann Arbor Public Schools to track those complaints and proactively, you know, take action against racism in Pioneer and other schools in its district. And so implementing a formal race discrimination complaint system and enthusiastically encouraging students to use it would, you know, not only give students an outlet to be heard, but also allow the district to be proactive in dismantling institutional racism. And last but not least, we're also asking for the school to start the termination procedures against the specific teacher that has harmed our client, Michaela Kelsey, this year.
Has there been any official response, or, and I guess unofficial response even, from the district or the teachers at the center of the story?
Everything went out this morning. So we will be seeing, you know, I think the same response time for everything. But we have gotten an acknowledgement email from the superintendent, and that's about it so far.
We should say that we also reached out to Ann Arbor Public Schools and received a short statement back from its spokesperson, Andrew Cluley. And it reads as follows: in the Ann Arbor Public Schools, we stand strongly against any and all acts of racism, bigotry, and bias. We will not comment publicly on personnel processes or pending litigation. Liza, are there legal measures in place that should have prevented what happened?
You know, there are a couple of things that we believe have been violated, at least in the course of action by this particular teacher. You know, Michaela's grades were displayed publicly on a smart board on a day that she was absent from school. And this is actually a violation of the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. That's a federal statute that protects privacy of students' educational records. And, you know, that's definitely something that we are alleging has been violated. We also have the Michigan Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act, which is the Michigan civil rights statute. But, you know, it's really up to the district to police itself, its teachers and staff, and to really formalize a dedication to dismantling institutional racism. And, you know, it's really up to them to correct what's happened so far and to prevent things like this from happening in the future.
Yeah. Where does this story fit, do you think, into the broader context of the Black Lives Matter movement?
So I think that it's directly tied to the Black Lives Matter movement because, you know, so much has happened this summer alone. But, you know, for years and years and generations of Black Americans, you know, racism is not just something that happens with the police. It's something that happens at every stage and phase of life, including in educational environments. And, you know, we have a lot of students who have complained of coded language being used and just being treated with less compassion than their white counterparts. And that's a part of this this time right now. It's not just about, you know, Black people being killed by the police, which is egregious and horrible and terrible. It's also about the ways that from birth to death, Black people are being treated in all kinds of ways that devalue their lives.
Ann Arbor is a city that prides itself on its progressive character and history. What does it tell us that things like this are, that complaints like this are present in the schools to this day?
It just tells us that racism is a problem everywhere. It can happen anywhere. And, you know, not only is it possible that students would have complaints about race discrimination in Ann Arbor, it's likely that, you know, this is the case across Michigan and across the country. And at least in terms of Michigan, we encourage Black students and students of color across the state to speak out as the students in Ann Arbor have. But, you know, the thing about Ann Arbor is that it is really liberal in some ways, which is amazing. And I think that that just proves the point that past and present racism is something that every American community faces and must actively work against. And Ann Arbor is no exception.
You know, we might say that there are any number of communities around Michigan that are actively wrestling with these issues right now, as the school year begins to start and as everything else is happening. Racial discrimination doesn't appear to be limited to one high school or institution. Why was this case the one that you wanted to work on? Why is it important to address in this context?
Well, it's important to address because, you know, change has to start somewhere. And we're seeing, you know, across the nation, change is happening, but they're also happening at a local community by community based level. And so Ann Arbor needs to have this reckoning, just like, you know, other cities, other towns, and other communities in Michigan do need to do this as well. And so this case came to us because Michaela Kelsey and her mother, Charmel Kelsey, they felt something needed to be done. And they knew that what Michaela faced and what other Black students and students of color had faced had gone ignored long enough. And they wanted to demand change. And so that's why we're here.
Liza Davis is representing Michaela Kelsey and her family in the civil rights litigation currently before the state, calling on Pioneer High School in Ann Arbor to make some changes in how Black students are treated. Liza Davis, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
In just a minute, we consider dancing and relaxation, activities that have been a lot more challenging in the era of COVID-19. We talk with the owner of a Mid-Michigan dance studio and one massage therapist from Southeast Michigan when Stateside returns. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Though schools and daycares have been allowed to reopen under Phase 4 of the governor's COVID reaction plan, there are still some kinds of classes that remain frozen in place, and those are the ones that happen at dance academies. They are still under a state-mandated lockdown. Susan Bird, the director of Living Arts Dance Studio, with locations in Williamston and Mason, has made some outdoor instruction work this summer, but with fall just around the corner, she's trying to get her students back inside, and we're going to talk to her today about how she thinks they might do so. Susan Bird, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So your studios teach a whole variety of classes for a whole variety of ages, everything from more freeform creative movement to jazz and tap and Broadway-style dancing. How's your studio been holding up since the pandemic got started?
Just barely. It's been a really difficult time. When the pandemic started, we saw that it was trending across the country, and I'm a member of a dance teacher Facebook page that has members actually internationally, and so we knew it was going to happen, so we planned ahead for when it did happen, and we just went into action. So, of course, we did lose students right away, and then our enrollment dropped, and then as summer approaches and we were not able to do a spring recital, we always normally lose more enrollment in the summer. So we've had some camps and we've had them outside and we've had pretty good attendance, but then, you know, you're dealing with, it's really hot right now and It's hard to keep kids engaged. So yeah, our fall session is right around the corner. We're enrolling new students, but people are just not sure, you know, they're afraid. But as far as the people that have enrolled, 99% of those parents want their kids back in the studio.
You know, the thing that strikes me about this, and I'm sure this is true for people who have kids involved in sports too, is this is a time when kids desperately need some physical outlet, and
yet oh, for sure,
they can't really do it.
That's correct. I'm hearing it from parents, and it's just a really difficult time for everybody. We're all going through this. But when I do see kids, you know, outside in the park and they're dancing, and I'm just watching the expressions on their face and the movement through their bodies and how it's so healing and beneficial for them. I mean, from head to toe and from body to soul, it's just one of those things that people need. Dance makes you happy.
Have you been able to get any financial aid?
We received a small stimulus check of $1,000, which covered like, you know, a third of our rent for 1 month.
Oh, wow.
So that was it. And yeah, I've got some grant applications out, but haven't heard anything. So we're such a small business. We have, you know, very little payroll. We have a few instructors. So it's just, you know, just keep our fingers crossed and hope that we get some help.
Did I hear you say that some parents are anxious to get their kids back in a studio environment?
Yes. Parents are just like, we're waiting for you to open up. I'm not going to sign my kid up until we know you're going to have in-studio classes. And the people who have registered so far, 99% of those parents want their kids to take in-studio classes. At this point, if we can't, we will offer Zoom classes. But we did a poll and only 7% of parents wanted their kids to take a Zoom class. So that makes us difficult to move forward with a class schedule.
Do you think it's safe to teach in a studio?
I know it's safe to teach in the studio. I've talked to other instructors across the country who have already opened. Many studios have been open since May, even in Florida, and they're doing it. We have a safety plan in action. We know that we can make it happen safely. These other studios have had, many of them have had no cases, and some of them I have talked to had maybe one or two cases, but they weren't from the studio. They were from, you know, another family member who contracted it another way. So we know that we can have safe classes. We can socially distance. We're dancers. We're good at spacing people out, and we're planning on wearing masks, cleaning in between classes. We have 10 minutes between classes scheduled for when we can go in the studio. We have one class exiting and entering from one doorway while another one exits and enters from a different doorway. So we can control that. There's just so much that we can do when we get a chance.
Are you worried about having to close the studio permanently?
For sure. I mean, at this point, it's a matter of how long do I teach for free and just cover the bills. Dance is my passion. And I think if you talk to a lot of studio owners, they do it because they love it. I mean, we work very hard for what we do. We love our kids, and I will hold on for as long as I can. But it is a scary thought.
For sure. You know, when you describe the methods that you are ready and willing to take to make this work safely in a studio environment, you know, the masking, the physical distance, I wonder, you know, having that kind of space and having the mask, from a dancer's point of view, is this really the dance that they will get some meaning out of?
Oh, for sure. I mean, no matter what we have to do, we will get meaning out of dance. We could just, you know, for little kids, just tell them it's part of a costume. I mean, there's ways of making this fun. There's ways of working through it. And I mean, it's just something that we have to do right now. And I know that the benefits way outweigh the, you know, putting a mask on over your face. And I know that we can modify movement so it's not difficult for kids. I mean, we're obviously not going to be doing a lot of, you know, interactive movement because we can't right now. So that's just part of the stuff that you just choreograph in. It's just part of something that dancers just automatically and naturally do.
What would you say is getting you through this right now?
My love for dance, the response that I have received from very supportive parents and from students, some thank you cards and words of encouragement help, and encouraging family. So I've got a wonderful husband and two kids that are watching me work my butt off. And so it helps.
Are there ways in which this new paradigm has made an imprint on your feelings about choreography? I don't know if choreography involving partnering was a big part of your practice to begin with, but have you just been thinking in different ways about how solo work happens, or, you know, just what's possible within the constraints that you're working in?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it was one of the first things that was on my mind, because when COVID hit, we still had a competition team that was scheduled to still go to competitions. And one of the dances we have like props, and there's parts where they're passing the props to each other. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't know. We can't do that. And it ended up where the competitions did get postponed for this coming season. So we didn't have to deal with it, but it is something where I'm looking ahead and going, okay, I'm definitely going to change my choreography, and we can still do very meaningful pieces just in a different way. This is our new normal. And there's parts of that I would really like to memorialize, because this is something that we're going through, and for people to dance through it will be helpful.
What do you mean when you think about how this moment can be memorialized?
Well, when we were not able to do an in-person dance recital, we decided to do a virtual recital. And that was part of like how I wanted to memorialize this. So we had kids send in footage, video footage of them in their dance recital costumes, doing the dances, as well as some still photos. And then in between dances, we did clips of everything that we have gone through. And then we've also done, we did clips of Zoom videos. We did a production number that was actually a Zoom production number. So we used the Zoom boxes as part of the choreography. So all of that stuff is just ways of using what we've gone through and remembering it. So the video that we put together is amazing. And the parents were like, wow. So it is a really nice keepsake to see what we have gone through and for people to go back and go, yeah, this is what it was like.
Would you say that your own dance practice has been very grounded in dancing with others?
Yes, for sure. I mean, dance is social. I mean, when you think about good times, I mean, it's dancing at weddings. It's being together and dancing. It's TikToks. I mean, TikToks are so popular with kids right now. And dance is a very social event. And yet, of course, it's way more fun to do it with people.
Right. Well, Susan, thank you so much for talking to us about this. And good luck this fall.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Susan Bird is director of Living Arts Dance Studio in Williamston and in Mason. Physical contact is not to everyone's taste, even healthy years, but for many people, the healing power of touch is absolutely essential to both physical and mental well-being. Some businesses in Michigan have reopened back in June, but for others, day-to-day life is still anything but normal. We wanted to talk to a massage therapist about how things are going in that line of work. And Heidi Johnson is on the line with us now. She's the owner of Thrive Massage and Body Work in Ann Arbor. Heidi Johnson, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April.
Well, like a number of other services, you were completely shut down for 3 months in the springtime. And so I guess that means you've been back open now for 9 weeks. How's it going?
You know, it's going well, exactly. I mean, for starters, we were closed for 3 full months per Governor Whitmer's executive orders, March 15th to June 15th. And I knew early on during the lockdown that really in order to safely reopen Thrive, I would have to overcome some obstacles. You know, given the nature of massage therapy, you have 2 people in close proximity for an extended period of time and we're indoors. So with that in mind, I mean, I was like, how does one create an environment that is as safe as possible and relaxing to promote the full relaxation experience? So, you know, I spent most of the month of May really researching industry safety standards and absolutely like visualizing every detail of my interaction with clients so that I could really have a smooth, seamless process.
So what are the protocols that you've put in place? How are you going about your work right now?
That involved some basic business changes as well as back to practice safety guidelines. So pre-pandemic, I had about 4 staff members plus myself with capacity to see maybe 10 to 15 clients total per day. And as of today at Thrive, we're only partially open. So my staff has not returned yet. I'm limiting my daily clients to 2 or 3. And these are mostly regular clients that I've been seeing, you know, pre-pandemic. And we've reported no illnesses. So, you know, really looking at limiting sessions to 60 minutes or less. My online booking schedule is closed off. We've modified our cancellation policy with no fees for cancellations at the last minute. And a lot of COVID safety guidelines. So I do an intensive pre-session screening phone call the day before the clients come in. Of course, when they arrive, we have temperature taking, more symptom review, intense office disinfecting, safety during the session, limiting table talk. And my preparedness, changing my mask between clients, changing my apron, you know, wiping down my face shield, everything in the office is put through a thorough disinfecting protocol between clients. And it takes a while. So I've had to build in more time between clients as well. And then we do a post-session follow-up within a week after seeing the people. You know, I send out this post-session check-in to make sure symptoms are okay and for feedback to see how their experience was.
So you mentioned that you have not reported any cases associated with the practice at this point. Have you been tested?
I had the antibody test back in June, and I had a pretty in-depth talk with my primary care physician about this. And what I'm aware of in this area is testing for asymptomatic folks is taking maybe 10 days to 2 weeks. So I'm not sure that me getting tested would be, you know, something that would prove to be helpful each day when I'm seeing clients, because the turnaround time on the testing results is up to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. But with the antibody test, I did come back negative with that.
Right.
So I have not been exposed to the virus at this point.
I mean, do you wish that there were more tests available so that you could be on this a little bit more?
Yeah, I feel that there are tests available. I just don't think that they're prioritizing patients who are coming in that have no symptoms. And as far as I know, I haven't been exposed, so I have no risk of exposure as far as I know. And so, you know, they do a lot of pre-screening before people come in to find out exactly what their concerns are. Yes, I do wish the turnaround time was quicker on that, because I would get tested, you know, every 7 to 14 days if that were the case.
Heidi, when the governor issued her executive order, and then it changed in June, and there was this period of reopening, did you ever consider maybe staying closed, either out of concern for your own health or because you weren't sure if the client base would come back?
I definitely was on the fence about reopening. And I'll tell you what's interesting about that is, of course, the numbers were much lower in mid-June. So I felt that that was the best time to open on one level, but I also didn't want to rush it. The other thing that I had to take into consideration is the PPP loan. The complicated nature of that and those rules continue to change. And at that point, back in June, I had 8 weeks to use a small amount of money that I got from the PPP loans. And I wanted to build revenue, which is one of the ways you can get the loan forgiven.
We tend to think of massage therapy as something that is a luxury or sort of like a spa treatment. But there are sometimes medical reasons for it with respect to like sports medicine or people who are recovering from some kind of surgical experience. What would you say you're seeing in terms of need and demand for services right now?
Yeah, what I'm noticing is that this pandemic has been taking its toll on people. It's mentally exhausting. It's anxiety provoking. And then we think about people who actually live alone, and they're really touch starved. And so some people are just feeling like, what a relief to actually come in and receive a massage. And then, of course, I do have people who, you know, had to postpone hip replacements or knee replacements, and you know, they were able to have that service this summer, and I won't be able to see them until probably September or October. So I do have people who are, you know, not only recovering from some recent surgeries, but also ongoing chronic pain, some new acute pain that has surfaced. So it's a variety of things. But really, I just want to point out that, you know, just the toll that this is taking on people mentally and emotionally, I'm hearing that and having them come in for massage, they're just so appreciative that we've opened back up.
Heidi, people walk into a massage therapist's workspace looking for a sense of relaxation. Mm-hmm. The lighting is usually dim. There's usually some soft music or, you know, nature sounds or something being played. Sometimes there are, you know, essential oil scents all throughout the air, and everything is just designed to be calming. Do you find you can truly be as calm as people need you to be right now?
That is the delicate balance right now. In the face of a pandemic, that I'm open and able to create this environment for clients. You know, really, it starts with me. It starts with each massage therapist finding, you know, that calm space, feeling like they're making the right decision to return to work, that they can offer relaxation to their clients, and that the office, even though my office is really bare bones right now, I've removed a lot of the comfortable, cozy items due to the business changes I've made, you know, we're still able to have a very quiet, inviting space, which I'm very proud of. And when I'm about to touch somebody's body, I feel this sense of relaxation and just joy that I can actually be there as safe as possible and provide them with this amazing touch.
Well, Heidi Johnson, I want to thank you so much for talking to us, and we hope you're able to keep going with business through the fall and winter.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you, April. It was a real pleasure speaking with you today.
Heidi Johnson is the owner of Thrive Massage and Body Work in Ann Arbor. We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. Next up, it's a conversation with the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver on making the magazine welcoming for all the gearheads.
The auto industry is going through the same stuff it went through in 2008, 2009. It's just there's so many other voices and so many other impacted communities that, you know, nobody's really kind of fully addressing what's happening in the auto industry.
That's just ahead. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The auto industry has so often been a lens for us in understanding trends in American business and American life. This year, that's probably as true as it's ever been. Like so many American businesses, car makers have dealt with pandemic issues in 2020 relating to the global supply chain, its workforce, and the Black Lives Matter movement has as much to say about factories and design shops and dealerships as it does about police departments. The big three are still facing fundamental questions about where they're headed. Everyone thought we'd be spending 2020 talking about a new generation of electric and autonomous vehicles. It's not clear whether those changes will still be at the top of the agenda. For the first time in its history, Car and Driver magazine, one of the leading publications in the industry, has a woman leading that conversation. Sharon Silk Cardi is editor-in-chief at Car and Driver, and she joins us now. Sharon, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm sure this is an understatement to say that it's not the 2020 anybody imagined, but Car and Driver's main job is in no small part reviews, telling people things they might want to know about cars that they might want to buy. Has anything essential changed about delivering that information?
Oh, boy. Yeah. I mean, we, for a while, just weren't getting any new cars or many new cars. The whole process of everything that we do kind of ground to a halt, like everybody else. So a lot of our reviews actually happen on the road. And so we, you know, we fly to some place and we meet the automaker there and they have cars there. And, you know, we go through these fancy drives in these fancy places, which make for really good photos and for fun stories. And just all of that stopped. So we've had to be really creative with what we do and what we take a look at.
What do you write about when there are no new cars?
Well, we did an issue that we called the Bug Out Guide, which was essentially like, what do you do in a disaster scenario, motivated by what was happening in the world? So, you know, road trips and how to fix your own cars and, you know, all of the fun things that we could think of doing while we were stuck in our house. We ended up doing another issue, which was we called the GOAT edition, which was just the greatest of all time, where we've looked at like all of our favorite cars since the magazine started in 1955. And, you know, we've just slowly been trying to piece it all together. We've run a lot of archive reviews online, so stuff that normally had just been in the magazine, you know, from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We found a way to get that all online. So we're adapting and we're rolling with it, but it's not been at all what we expected.
Before Car and Driver, you led a team at Automotive News that looked at urban mobility, and you were there to witness this long, slow build going on, often behind the scenes at the automakers toward autonomous vehicles, hybrid engines, electric engines, and sort of rethinking cars' effects on our cities and our environment. Where do you see that conversation standing right now?
Well, I think all of that work is still happening, but I think We haven't yet seen the full financial impact of everything that's happened. You know, last time there was a major financial crisis in 2008, 2009, the auto industry really was like the center, or at least one of the centerpiece topics during that, because it was such a major impact. This crisis is totally different in that, like, you know, the auto industry is going through the same stuff it went through in 2008, 2009. It's just there's so many other voices and so many other impacted communities that, you know, nobody's really kind of fully addressing what's happening in the auto industry. And so at the moment, I think everything is still chugging along as planned. I don't think we've seen the full financial brunt. A lot of that innovation is just so costly.
Yeah, and cars are one of those things where you sort of have to anticipate the consumer market a couple of years ahead of time. It's not like just-in-time delivery can present you with what people want, you know, 3 months after somebody decides that they want it.
Right. And so there's this huge, you know, will people be able to afford new cars? The average transaction price on a new car right now is $38,000, you know, and that actually hasn't gone down over the last few months. Like, it's stayed pretty consistent. The inventory of new cars is down, so they're able to kind of, like, there's the supply and demand thing is working in their favor. But, you know, there's discussions like, are people going to be commuting to work? How is that going to impact things? Will anybody take buses and public transit anymore? Like, how is that going to impact things? So it's just wild right now. Nobody knows. It feels like we're in stasis and we're just like waiting to for something to happen to at least kind of have a feeling of where things are going.
Do you foresee the big three still being in a position to invest in new electric technologies and autonomous technologies on the other side of this?
I think that they will. I think that they've made some really hard financial decisions in the last few years that show that they recognize that a lot of that is the future. If the U.S. politically is not behind electric cars or fuel economy and all that stuff, the rest of the world appears to be. And the auto industry is now very much a global, you can't just make something for the U.S. car market, right? Like, you've got to make something that you can sell almost anywhere. The automakers seem to recognize that they need to be making those investments to keep up with the rest of the world. And so they're making decisions like, you know, Ford has walked away from sedans, you know, like they just are not making them except for a couple. General Motors walked away from Europe, you know, like they were just like, we're not making any money here. So we're just, instead of continuing to try this, like, we'll just walk away. And those are hard decisions to make, but then you can take that money that you save and put it into investing in your future. And that's crucially important.
Yeah. We learned in recent weeks that Ford's CEO, Jim Hackett, is retiring, and he's done the things that ostensibly any auto company board would want in more popular SUVs, more investments in electric technology at the same time. And yet it wasn't enough to prolong his tenure. I mean, is there anything the industry can do to thread the needle at a time of wild economic upheaval?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting case because I think that a lot of the traditional automakers face this conundrum of that they're always being compared to Tesla. And Tesla, because they have no gas-powered cars, like, if you're a diehard environmentalist or you're not feeling like you're funding sort of big oil when you buy a car from Tesla. And there's no way for them to really compete with that. And they can really be doing an excellent job on many levels, but they can't compete with a Tesla with that mindset. And so, you know, for publicly traded companies, it's a really difficult task. I'm not sure that there is really very much that they can do right now other than completely reinvent themselves. And that's a long, hard task to undertake and could take decades.
Yeah, no pressure.
Right.
There are a lot of other things going on right now. This month's issue of Car and Driver includes an interview with NASCAR's Bubba Wallace. He is the only Black driver at his level in the industry. And he talks about the fact that he didn't really pay attention to racism within NASCAR when he was younger, but he sounds ready to address it now. And he talked to your reporter about why it's important for everyone to understand why Black people are angry right now and understand why they're hurt. What kind of feedback did you get on the article?
We're getting a lot of negative feedback on it, which is not surprising to me, because it's not uncommon to touch on something that's fairly political in automotive, you know, enthusiasm. And the feedback that you get almost right away is, this is not what I want you to talk about. I don't come to you to talk about serious topics. I come to you because I want to be distracted from the outside world. And it's, you know, it doesn't go unnoticed by me that these are largely male voices who are writing these emails. And it's interesting because as a woman in the industry, you know, I can never really escape being a woman in the industry. You know, like that's not something I can walk away from. Like it is. And sometimes it's an issue and sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, luckily, it's not. But it's still like every time I walk into a meeting, like it is what it is. And I know that I'm being viewed in a different way from other folks.
You know, it was interesting that you did an interview with General Motors Mary Barra a couple of years ago, in which she said that she never really thought about her position as being one of the lone female executives in the industry until she became aware that she was a figure of inspiration for people. Whether or not we believe that she really didn't think too much about it or whether it didn't really have an impact on her life, it seems like she was reacting to a need that people have to believe that it doesn't matter. I wonder if you think the auto industry is in a place where it's ready to start talking about some of those issues that might lead a driver like Bubba Wallace or a CEO like Mary Barra to say it hasn't mattered in my career.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that conversation with Mary Barra was incredibly interesting because that's obviously not been my experience that it doesn't matter. It was interesting to hear her say that, but it also was really interesting to have her like acknowledge that it is important to people. I don't think she wanted it to matter, right? I think she wanted just to be judged on her own skills and abilities, which is what we all want to have happen. But the positive feedback that she got, you know, really kind of made her realize that, yeah, this is a big deal and it can actually be really cool. That's what I'm hoping that these conversations, like the one we had about Bubba Wallace and the conversations that we're going to continue to have, because we're not going to shy away from it, even if it makes people uncomfortable, that it will sort of, even if it makes our current readership uncomfortable, that maybe it will welcome in a new generation of folks who are excited by the fact that we're finally talking about these topics and who feel welcome in the pages of Car and Driver where they may not have before. And I don't think that you make people feel welcome by ignoring issues, right? You actually have to address it. You actually have to say like, yeah, this is the thing that's going on. And, you know, let's have this conversation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sharon Silk Cardi. She's editor-in-chief at Car and Driver magazine. Are there cars that are on the market right now that you are excited about?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Do you want me to go through the list? Because it could be kind of long.
Go nuts.
Well, I'm a big SUV. Not SUV. I really like off-roading. So I'm really into the new Jeep Gladiator, which we had in a little while ago. It's a ridiculous truck. It makes me feel like I'm just kind of, you know, burning fossil fuels for no reason whatsoever, but it's just so much fun. And there's a lot of cars that are just a lot of fun. And the coronavirus has slowed down a lot of production of vehicles. But I think that the industry is not going to lose that level of fun. It's a great place to be. And it's exciting. I really hope that we can kind of broaden this level of enthusiasm, because I think for a really long time, the walls to becoming an enthusiast were up pretty high. Like you had to prove a certain level of knowledge. You had to prove a certain level of, you know, driving ability.
You had to be able to change your own spark plugs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like you just had to be this certain kind of person. And I think, you know, more and more people are proving that you don't actually have to fit these molds. And we really want to welcome in, like, you know, all sorts of whatever it is, whatever you're interested in, whoever you are, and whatever your background is, like we want to welcome you into that because this place is this little slice of the universe can be just tremendously rewarding and a lot of fun.
You know, I'm interested that you favor the Gladiator, given the intense tsunami-like marketing push that Ford has subjected us all to for the Bronco. Why does the Gladiator get your nod?
You know, I am a bit of a Jeep girl. I love Jeeps so much. I am really excited to drive the Bronco, and there's a really solid chance that it will change my mind. But I just have had, it's one of those things, I've just had sort of a bias towards Jeeps for a very, very long time.
What's your best ever Jeep?
So there's a Jeep Rubicon in this Sahara yellow color that I absolutely love. I don't own it myself, but I might one day. I like the Jeeps that just, like, will do pretty much anything. Like, rock crawling and going about 5 miles an hour over a giant rock is, for me, incredibly, incredibly fun and thrilling. I can't quite explain it, but... I like to know that if the zombie apocalypse comes, I can just sort of drive over anything and get where I need to go.
You know, it is so interesting to me. I think people always assume that car people and car journalists want the newest, hottest, but I feel like most of the ones I've met are much more interested in older models.
Yeah, and really interested in just sort of like, you know, this one feature that has just, you know, made them really crazy and really, you know, pique their mind. And so they're just going to be fascinated with this thing because it's air cooled or because it makes this noise or something. Like, and real car people generally just don't have one favorite. They've got like a list of 12 things that they'll talk your ear off about.
It strikes me that the automotive press has a really unique challenge right now in that, to the extent there are cars to review, it's not like you can't drive them anywhere, but people aren't necessarily taking the kinds of drives either to work or sometimes for vacation that they would have in a different year than 2020. How are you dealing with that?
Well, I mean, we're doing as much driving as we can. We have like certain quotas that we have to hit on certain cars. So we're driving as much as we can. And what we're seeing is that people are taking road trips and staying closer to home. You know, the RV market is actually quite booming. Like, people are trying to drive with their own hotel room behind them because they don't want to go into hotels and they don't want to be in planes. So I think that there is some shortages of some models of cars. And so, you know, people are definitely still getting out there. It's just, again, this sort of stasis where everybody's not quite sure where we're heading. And so there's a lot of caution in the industry at the moment.
Please tell me that I don't need to get ready for the October issue of RVN Driver.
No, although I did joke in our recent, in our upcoming letter to the editor that we're renaming it SUV and Driver. So I'm going to be eagerly awaiting the letters on that one.
Right. As you mentioned, there are some companies that are really just kind of abandoning the sedan market. But outside of SUVs and light trucks, are there any cars coming out that we should be aware of that might be a focus for consumer trends in 2021?
Well, the Mercedes is unveiling its new S-Class pretty soon. And Mercedes is really interesting because they invest a ton in sort of like near autonomous technology. And they're really very good. You know, Tesla likes to market its autopilot as self-driving technology, but I would say Mercedes is actually sort of the closest to it because they've been working on it for a very long time and it's very well refined. So that is definitely one to keep an eye on.
Have you been in autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, I've been in the Google car, the Waymo self-driving car. I've done autopilot on Tesla Model 3, but I don't consider the autopilot self-driving car because technically it's not self-driving if you have to have a driver behind the wheel. So
right.
There are like no self-driving cars on the market right now. There's adaptive technology that helps you stay in your lane and cruise control that will like slow down if it sees a car in front of you. But there's actually zero self-driving cars on the market right now. But I have been in pre-production vehicles. I've been in some, you know, that will drive around a test track, and I've been around some that will drive around like certain areas in Silicon Valley. And, you know, what the most striking thing about them is that they get boring very fast. Like momentarily you're like, oh, wow, this is really cool. And then it's just like, oh, it's just driving like anybody else is driving. It's like being in a taxi. It's just doing its thing.
But Sharon, that gives you unprecedented opportunities to stare at your phone, right?
Exactly, which we all need more of.
Sharon Carty is the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Sharon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, April.
That's Stateside for today. The show is produced by Mike Blank and April Van Buren. It's directed by Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Tuesday.